From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Christopher Wray is the new boss of the FBI.
I'm very pleased that his name surfaced because I know how independent he is, and he's somebody who would be, as I say, serving justice in the Constitution and not a particular person.
That's Kent Alexander, a former U.S. attorney for the North District of Georgia. He's talking about the newly appointed FBI director, Chris Wray. We'll get several takes on the former Atlanta attorney this hour. First, though, last week we asked the Breakroom Gang, what is the shortest time that you have ever worked a job?
I used to sell Owen Mills portraits over the phone, and I did that for 2 months, and it was just like killing me.
That is Sumaya Khalifa, the executive director of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta. Here are your first thoughts.
Hi, it's Ed Hall calling from Atlanta's Beecher Donnelly neighborhood. I worked one day selling AT&T U-verse subscriptions door to door. It was one of the coldest days I remember in Atlanta's history. My feet were blue when I got home, but the thing that did it for me was a house with a Confederate battle flag in the window from which a dog was released to, perhaps not two, but it did harass me and the other African-American gentleman.
Hi, my name is Mark Parkinson calling from Rome, Georgia. I went to work as a car salesman for one day. And I just couldn't do it. They took me into a classroom and taught me this scheme of selling cars based on some triangle. I hate car dealerships to this day.
Hi, this is Chad from Atlanta, Georgia. You guys are talking about worst jobs ever. I actually went for what was deemed a working interview at a rabbit farm in East Alabama, which entailed pretty much just shoveling rabbit poop all day. And at the end of the interview, I spoke to a couple of the other guys that went, and no one was called back. So basically, I think they just needed their rabbit poop shoveled.
Way more people had a job for one day than I ever would have predicted. We'd love to hear your stories, so make sure you call us and tell us. The number is 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter, at OST Talk, and on Facebook. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. 50 years ago today, on August 7th of 1967, Floyd Hoard was murdered. Hoard was the district attorney of Jackson County. He was on his way to work, turned the ignition key in his Ford Galaxy, and suffered catastrophic injuries from the dynamite rigged to the car. That murder changed the course of law enforcement and politics in Georgia. Richard Hoard, Floyd's son, was 13 when his dad died, and he wrote a book about the experience called Alone Among the Living. He just published his fourth book, The Missing Boys, inspired by those same events. Richard Hoard is with me now. Hi there.
Thank you for having me, Celeste. Good to be here.
So 50 years on, is this still a difficult anniversary for you?
It's strange. I mean, I think the big thing for me now is it just reminds me I'm old, you know. At the age that I went through all of these things, I soaked it all in. It was such a catastrophic event. 7:20, my dad is eating breakfast. 7:30, he's turning the ignition to the car a little bit before that. And, you know, suddenly, you know, your world has changed. This explosion, which is something like an artillery round landing in your front yard. I was in the back of the house, and it blew out windows in the front of the house. And I came around to the side, and the devastation was... It was just awful. There are a lot of photographs of it. The book has photographs. The new book, I think, will continue to have those photographs. They're going to do a new edition of it.
Yeah. So. You know, in the book you write that your mother yells to you, I think your dad's been killed, and you think in your head, that's just like Mom, she's being dramatic again.
Yeah, you don't think that this can happen. I mean... you're so confused, you're so disoriented when a bomb is hit anyway. You know, your first thoughts are, well, it's a lightning strike. No, it's too loud. You're somebody shooting the shotgun at those goats again. Oh, that we sold the goats, you know. And then this, it just keeps reverberating. Your bunk bed is shaking in the back of the house. And then you're just confused, and you think your mother's is, you know, confused as well that your dad is already left the house and he's uptown somewhere. And what has this explosion got to do with anything with him? Then you turn the corner of the house and there you see it, and she may be right. And
You also say in the book that your uncle had warned your dad to put tape on the hood of the car to see if it had been messed with. I mean, it was clear that your dad knew he was in danger.
He did know he was in danger. We don't know, and my uncle and I would talk about it afterwards. We said we don't know why he did not do that, or why he didn't, if he did do it, why he didn't continue to do it. And in the book, I make the suggestion, do you want to live your whole life, every moment of your life, thinking that you're going to end up being killed? And we all thought, if he was in danger, I mean, he could. I didn't know how severe this was. I mean, I didn't know everybody was that scared. I knew he was in some dangerous situations, but I thought if anybody tried to tackle my dad would whip him. He was a good shot. He was strong, former football player. He had the strength where I didn't know what it took to do this, but he could hop up on his hands, throw his feet up in the air, and walk around on his hands. And an uncle said he could do that from home plate to the foul pole. So he's a very powerful man. And you just don't think that he's going to die this way. It was such an act of cowardice to come up into the yard and do that, because they didn't care who they killed. They could have killed the whole family. Yeah.
It turned out it was because of a price that had been put on your father's head by a chief of what was at the time called the Dixie Mafia. And this is a man that you often describe as being, he has the looks of somebody who's harmless. I mean, he keeps messing with the plate, plate in his mouth. Yeah. He looks at the jury. The speech that he gives is really innocuous and sort of like this harmless old guy. How did your feelings toward the old man who was responsible for your father's death, how did they evolve?
Well, when the first verdict, he was given the death penalty. And I remember saying out there in the courtroom, I said, I hope they let me pull the switch. I would have done that. I would have killed him. I would have done. But the evolution of that, and I can't say that I understood it at the time, but I could look back and see what was happening to me. I was beginning to hate everybody. I mean, because this is what, and I've talked to friends about it in recent years, this is how they were coached to deal with this, is don't bring this up to him. You'll make him sad. If something like that happened
now.
Your
friends were told not to talk about it.
That's right. That's the big thing. Don't bring it up. Don't talk about it. Distract him. Get him, thinking something else. Try to take him away from this. And today, if that happened, you'd have every counselor in the South running in there, not just to talk to me, but to talk to my friends who spent the night there with us, who he took to ball games, he was a little league coach. I mean, nobody knew how to deal with this. It wasn't just me and my family. It was a whole community in a lot of ways, at least among the kids. And so what you're doing when you're a kid, and Time Magazine has this, and Newsweek has it, and it's in the Atlanta papers, and it's all over the place, and they're not talking about it. Like, you think, they're acting like this didn't happen. So that's kind of where you get this title, Alone Among the Living. It's a very isolated feeling, and I don't think it's just for somebody who's gone through the kind of catastrophic thing that we went through. I think it's a very typical thing for folks, So,
I mean, I can't imagine how you could have avoided it. It turned out that you'd actually ridden to a ball game with one of the men responsible in the front seat, and his nephew ended up being your roommate at UGA.
He was at our dinner table yesterday. He's still my good friend. He came to church and came and ate with us. I mean, when you have something like this happen in a small town, there's so many people involved that, a lot of innocent people that they're suffering too, in a way. You know, it's an embarrassment to them. You know, how could any family member of mine have been a part of this? And, you know, it's not, you know, it's you find yourself rubbing elbows with all kind of people. And like you're talking about, I went to that Georgia football game. When that man heard my name, you know, I remember asking him if he was if he knew my friend James, and he nodded, and that's the only thing he had to say to me all day, because he had come to my grandmother's house in a car with another man. I'm sure what must have happened. He said, "We're going to stop and pick up Dickie Hoard," and what that man must have been thinking,
knowing he was responsible for your father's death.
Yeah, paid $500, contributed $500 because he was Park's right hand man.
So Park is the old man who was the head of that
Park
bootlegging. And your father had ended up sort of spearheading a raid in which Park had lost a lot of money in liquor when they raided it. What kind of understanding have you come to over the 50 years of the place your dad holds in law enforcement history? Because this was the first murder of its kind, and it was also the first a spur for the state to take control of the corruption in Jackson County.
Yeah, the GBI has authority even to this day to come in uninvited, you know.
The only county out of all of the counties in Georgia where that's
true.
That's
right. That's right. And I think the place is it woke everybody up to how corrupt everything really was. And this was a way of life, and I think this is why those people kill my dad. You know, here's this whippersnapper coming in here, and we've been doing this for 50 years, and he's now trying to break up the system that we have. It's a corrupt system. He's not playing the game, and that's one reason why they got rid of him, this vindictive killing. And I think that woke people up to say, okay, this is, this is real. These are not little guys sitting by the riverside making a little moonshine. This is big business. This is a group that thinks they're in control. And the governor got involved. The GBI very much got involved. And the citizens of the Piedmont Judicial Circuit, which was Jackson County, Barra, Banks, they woke up. This is not who we are and what we want to be. And a lot of people up there will tell you that's a turning point for them heading in different directions. I mean, there's going to be corruption all the time, but I think there are people that, you know, go in now and say, not me, I'm following what Floyd Hoard did. I will end up trying to uphold the law. I will try to, be the honest person I should be and go in and hold office and keep to the promises.
We are speaking with Richard Hoard. He is the author of Alone Among the Living. The book recounts the death of his father, former Jackson County District Attorney Floyd Hoard, in 1967. We'll continue this conversation in just a moment, and also a little bit more about the history of Jackson County. And then we'll take a hard look at the brand new FBI director, former Atlanta attorney Chris Wray. This is On Second Thought.
Rosa. Bearing down on me, I can feel the hands touching me. Oh, this thing's into position. Oh, this thing's a one day swallow whole.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. We've been talking with Richard Hoard. He's author of the book Alone Among the Living. That book revisits the events 50 years ago today that led to his father's death. And we were talking a moment ago about the bootlegger organization and Jackson County finally getting a hold of that. And I wonder how you view some of the almost cartoonish portrayals of the bootleggers and moonshiners, things, shows like Dukes of Hazzard that don't quite get at the danger of those organizations?
The only reason I ever would have watched the Dukes of Hazzard was to see Daisy Duke. And that's, that was one show that to me was just a little bit, I'd have to say, Well, it wasn't my favorite. How can I say that? I didn't watch the Dukes of Hazzard. I knew it. I knew Boss Hogg and all these guys, but this is not something that I would look at because it just is so unreal. And it's like I would call it the Hogan's Heroes of anything having to do with Southern life and Dixie Mafia or anything like that. What we saw was real. That morning was real. And there were a lot of things going on out there. Recently, a man died in prison who was responsible, he says, and the family says, for 56 murders, because this was a rough place up there. This was people went missing. People got shot on the streets. You know, we knew all of that kind of stuff. People got found in wells. It was a violent world that we were living in. There was nothing funny about it. And I guess really not that I thought about it with that show, but that's just not – Dukes of Hazzard wasn't something that I was going to end up looking at. Now, I'll tell you that the movie that affected me was Walking Tall, that first one, and that was the story of Buford Pusser. His wife was killed the same week my dad was killed. Same kind of stuff going up in Tennessee that was happening, you know, there in Jackson County.
So you write in the book about a visit you made to see old man Clark in the hospital. He was having operations for hernias. And it sounds, though, and maybe I was reading this wrong, it sounds like you weren't sure when you walked into the hospital room and saw him whether you still wanted to kill him or not.
I had those feelings. I mean, by then I'd had a spiritual awakening. I'd become a Christian. I was dealing with this, but I was still dealing with this anger. I mean, just because you become a Christian doesn't mean you've solved everything. And, I still had a lot of bitterness, had a lot of hatred. This was my symbolic way. Okay, I'm going in there and I'm going to see him. And in the process, I was able to really lay that hatred down. And that's been a big effect on me is, you know, he killed my dad. My hating him has done nothing to him. He could care less how I feel about him. And it's not going to bring my dad back for me to be spending probably lesser years than I would have lived now at this stage if I'd lived with that sort of burning anger in my heart all those years. And symbolically, I said, okay, it's not the forgiveness that it shouldn't be punished or that it should be overlooked, but it's the forgiveness that says what you have done to him will have no effect over me. And I will go on with my life. And to me, the only one who has the you know, real, you know, it's his place to forgive him would be my dad or God. And, you know, all I can do is forgive him for what his actions toward them did to me, and I can lay them down. So that's kind of how I came to that in the book.
You went to his funeral, though, and his wife told you he wasn't responsible. Still, yeah. Doesn't believe he was responsible.
Yeah, there were a lot of family members. Those guys, if you kind of watch the movie The Godfather, the women didn't know what those guys were up to, you know. And I'm convinced that a lot of the family members had no clue, you know, how involved their, you know, family members were. The men were in this loose organization they call the Dixie Mafia.
So obviously your father's memory will always be precious to you. I'm sure you keep it alive with your children and your book, of course. But why do you think it might be important for other Georgians to remember him and his sacrifice?
Because I think that something that my dad wrote that they found shortly after his death, and it is about could have been describing his own death to be. It could have been describing anything, but it's saying that when we look away and we just let it go and let corruption be all around us, inevitably this type of thing is going to happen. I mean, you can have your system and you can think, well, we got everything under control and people are paid off here and paid off here and nobody's really getting hurt. Eventually, somebody is going to suffer for this. And there'll be a murder. There'll be things that take place. So I think, you know, to watch what happens in government and what happens in the sheriff's department and in the prosecutor's office and all of this is, you know, this is important, and people, this kind of thing can happen again if we don't know what it is. I mean, history will repeat itself unless you learn from the lessons.
That's Richard Hordes, author of Alone Among the Living. That book details events surrounding the death, the murder of his father, Floyd Horde, 50 years ago today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Celeste.
Alone Among the Living is a selection of the Georgia Reads Book Club. That's a partnership between Georgia Public Broadcasting, the University of Georgia Press, and Georgia Humanities. If you want information on that, visit gpb.org/Georgia Reads. And you can also see Richard tonight at the historic Jackson County Courthouse at 7 p.m. He'll discuss the murder and his new book called The Missing Boys. If you use Georgia's exchange, your only option is Blue Cross Blue Shield. They are the only insurer to offer statewide plans in Georgia's exchange. Premiums are set to go up 40% in 2018. And Blue Cross just announced a new policy to limit coverage for ER visits under certain circumstances. Joining us now is Andy Miller, editor of Georgia Health, and Beth Stevens is senior director of public policy, Georgia Watch. Hello to both of you.
Hi.
Good to be here.
Georgia Health News, I should say there, Andy. Explain this new policy, how this works in Blue Cross's attempt. It sounds like what they're basically trying to do is get people to stop using the ER for their GP visits. But how does it function?
Well, it began July 1, so we don't have any real evidence as to how it's been working yet so far. But basically what Blue Cross is doing is saying, look, we don't want you to go to an ER to get care for something like a cold or a sinus infection or take stitches out, whatever. They want people not to use the emergency room for things that they can get in a doctor's office or in an urgent care center. So they have decided that they're simply, if they deem that an ER visit is not appropriate for whatever symptoms that the person has, they're not going to pay for that care. And it will fall back on the consumer to pay for it. And obviously, it's caused a lot of eyebrows to be raised. It's caused concern. Consumer groups, state regulators say that they're going to be watching this policy carefully to make sure that people don't get shut out of coverage that they should get.
Beth, the problem is we don't exactly have clarity on what's considered necessary treatment and what is not. How do we know? How is a insured person supposed to know what Blue Cross will consider necessary or not?
Yeah, well, I understand that they're looking at it from a layperson's standard, so that's a good thing, but. There are, you're asking the consumer to self-diagnose and make a determination about whether the ER care is appropriate. And there was a study from 2016 in a reputable medical journal that found that 6 out of the top 10 patient symptoms that are described in non-emergent ER visits are actually symptoms of true emergencies, like lower back pain, abdominal and chest pain, sore throat, headache. So someone may be having a true emergency and not recognize that because they're not a medical professional and not aware of the symptoms. And that's what concerns us. And it also concerns us that a consumer, many consumers can't afford an extra $400, $500, $1,000 unexpected bill, and what that does to a consumer's credit, how they're going to pay for that bill if they're not expecting it, is concerning to us.
The other concern, of course, would be that in a healthy insurance environment, that if they didn't like this particular policy, they could go to another insurer. So it's complicated by the fact that Blue Cross is the only statewide insurer available on the exchange, right? How does that work?
Well, in this past year, in 96 out of 159 Georgia counties, Blue Cross was the only insurer available. So, there are...
Mostly rural?
Most of the people in Georgia that have ACA marketplace individual policies live in the metro area just because we have such a high population and concentration. And here in metro Atlanta, consumers do have a few choices. In the more rural areas, Blue Cross is the only insurer. In metro Atlanta and northern Georgia, there are a couple more options for people in terms of provider or insurers available on the exchange. But yeah, we're concerned about the people that, you know, only have Blue Cross as a policy and, you know, this the implications of this new policy they're rolling out.
There's a couple things, Andy, that you and I have talked about in the past that come into play here. And the first is the fact that, especially in rural areas, there's not always a general practitioner close by. I mean, one of the things that has become a problem, not just in Georgia, but nationwide, is that it's getting harder and harder to get doctors to go into general practice. Does it matter how far you are from a GP to Blue Cross?
It does. They say that there's an exemption for people that are so many miles away from an urgent care center or like a drugstore clinic, and they'll exempt those people from this policy. But yeah, rural areas have they tend to be poorer, they tend to have more people without insurance, and they tend to, as you say, not have enough doctors, primary care doctors. I mean, they're scarce in many areas of rural Georgia.
Let's talk then a little bit about the second thing that you and I discussed in the past, and I'm wondering how this relates to either the raise in premiums or the Blue Cross Blue Shield policy. Here's a comment from Georgians for a Healthy Future. They're explaining about the coverage gap.
More than 3 million Americans fall into a health insurance coverage gap. This means they make too little money to qualify for tax credits to purchase health insurance on healthcare.gov and too much to qualify for Medicaid coverage. They're stuck in the gap with no affordable insurance options.
So, Beth, people who are in a coverage gap before, that may include more people if premiums are going up 40%. Yes, or is that wrong?
Well, the subsidies that people receive from the federal government to help them pay for marketplace insurance, you know, they're not going away right now.
Right.
I mean, there's some concern about that, but at least at the federal level in Congress, you know, the bills didn't pass that would change the subsidies. So people are still getting the subsidies. If the price of insurance goes up, the subsidy will go up too.
Right, but we're talking about the people who didn't meet the qualifications to get a subsidy, Andy.
Right. Those are kind of the working poor people. And Georgia did not expand its Medicaid program, unlike 31 other states that did. And so you have people that, as the person just said, they make too much money to qualify for Medicaid as is in Georgia, but they're not eligible for the subsidies in the exchange. And so they're kind of in a double whammy there, and they tend, again, not to be uninsured because of that. And we have a very high rate of uninsured people, something like 14%. It's one of the top percentages in the country.
Could it go up? The reason I ask this is I wonder if somebody was able to paying Blue Cross premiums out of their pocket and premiums are about to go up 40%, that could increase the number of uninsured in Georgia.
Yes, it could. Now, I will say that there's another factor going on, and that is what's happening at the White House administration level, and that is whether the insurers will get these subsidies for people to lower their deductibles and out-of-pocket costs in the exchange. The Trump administration has threatened to cut them off. The White House has also signaled that they will not, or they're thinking about not enforcing the tax penalty for people that don't get insurance. So both of those things could lead to more uninsured people.
And Beth, that brings us to the other point, which is that perhaps, how possible is it that these changes at Blue Cross Blue Shield are caused by, at least in part, by this uncertainty in D.C. over what may happen with subsidies and what may happen with healthcare, period?
Yeah, there's a lot of unpredictability right now, as Andy pointed out, in terms of those cost-sharing subsidies and, you know, what type of legislation we could see from Congress that might, you know, change the structure of the way the Affordable Care Act currently works. And that unpredictability has led to insurers pulling out of marketplaces here in Georgia and in other parts of the country. And so, yes, that is happening.
But in the 40 seconds that we have left, Andy, this is going to cause more complications. It could increase the number of uninsured, and it could also end up, there could be a mistake where someone should go to the ER and doesn't.
Right. And so there's a couple things going on, but there's a lot of confusion in the marketplace, a lot of instability. Insurers are feeling it, and consumers are feeling it as well.
That is Andy Miller. He's editor of Georgia Health News, and Beth Stevens is senior director of public policy at Georgia Watch. Thanks so much to both of you.
Glad to be here.
Yes, thank you.
Just ahead, former Atlanta attorney Chris Wray is confirmed as the new FBI director. We take a look at what this may mean for the ever-widening Russia investigation. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow, we go a little wild. Filmmakers behind the latest Planet of the Apes film wanted their movie apes to sound as authentic as possible. So they asked a University of Georgia professor to help. And now we want your recommendations for great animal movies. What is the best movie you've seen that features an animal? Call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. And then, of course, be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Last week, the U.S. Senate approved Christopher Wray as FBI director. The former Atlanta attorney was confirmed on a 92-5 vote. Here's Wray during his confirmation hearing.
My loyalty is to the Constitution and to the rule of law. Those have been my guideposts throughout my career, and I will continue to adhere to them no matter the test.
Christopher Wray replaces former FBI Director James Comey, who was fired by President Trump in May. Shortly after Trump announced plans to nominate Wray in June, I spoke with someone who knows him well. Kent Alexander is a former U.S. attorney for the North District of Georgia, and he hired Wray to work in his office. So tell me, I mean, there are things that the American public is concerned about with the next FBI director. And one of the things I imagine concerns a lot of people is this idea of a loyalty oath that Trump has reportedly asked not just James Comey for, but has many of his employees he has asked them for, if we are to believe reports, and Trump himself. What do you think Christopher Wray might make of a loyalty oath?
It's one oath he wouldn't take. I think he'd take an oath to the Constitution, he'd take an oath to justice and doing the right thing, but a loyalty oath to any president just isn't the way he works.
What about Christopher Wray's approach to justice and to government in and of itself? How did he see himself as a member of law enforcement?
Well, he's a straight shooter. He's just right down the middle. I was really struck by how he was driven by public service, he was driven by the Constitution, he was driven by what was the right thing to do. So having somebody like that at the FBI, particularly at a time like this, I think is key. And I was surprised and pleased when I saw the president announce he was going to nominate him.
But did you get any sense while working with Christopher of partisan politics, that any decisions were influenced by the fact that he's a Republican? Do you feel he was ever influenced by that?
No, not at all. In fact, one of the unique things about U.S. attorney's offices generally, but in Atlanta particularly, it's just a nonpartisan office. People come in, and I hired Republicans, I hired Democrats, but the way people approach prosecutions is just by the book. So in that office, I was always struck, and I spent 11 years there, by the lack of politics.
Let's hear James Comey. This is during his testimony before the Senate.
The nature of the FBI and the nature of its work requires that it not be the subject of political consideration. You see it in my testimony. I also tried to explain to him why it's in his interest and every president's interest for the FBI to be a part in a way, because its credibility is important to a president and to the country.
How prepared do you think Christopher Wray would be, you are his boss, in terms of talking truth to power, in terms of being able to stand up for their own job against pressure?
Sure. Well, for starters, I was Chris's boss 20 years ago, and happily he's had a huge amount of experience between then and now.
That is correct.
But having kept up with him and kept up with his career, I think he's extraordinarily well prepared. He, at the U.S. Attorney's Office, he worked directly with FBI agents day to day, so he knows the down and dirty of how a case is made. At the Justice Department, he worked with Larry Thompson, who was Deputy Attorney General, who brought him up there as his right-hand man, basically. And he oversaw a lot of terrorism investigations. He worked with the FBI a lot. He operated the highest levels of the department. He then went on to head the criminal division of the Justice Department, which is basically the person who oversees all of the criminal prosecutions across the country and works directly with the FBI. So he's really been in the mix in Washington in a political setting, and he's also since really excelled as a private practitioner. So he really has it covered at all levels, so as prepared as anybody can be for a position like this.
Even though he's never worked, he's worked with but not for the FBI.
Exactly, much like Jim Comey, Judge Sessions, Bob Mueller, a lot of people who've been directors have been in exactly that position.
I wanted, before I let you go, to read you something, a comment that Representative John Conyers made. Conyers, of course, is the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, and he's concerned about the choice. He says, quote, "I am deeply concerned the next director is being selected according to the criteria of a president whose campaign and administration are under investigation and who fired the prior FBI director on the basis of his zeal in investigating these matters and refusal to swear loyalty to the president." That sounds like he's saying, I'm concerned about Christopher Wray because he was selected by President Trump. How would you answer that?
Well, that means by definition, whoever the president selects, he's going to be concerned about. So that doesn't really concern me that much. I think it's a good time for people to start focusing less on the nominator, and who's controversial in many quarters, and more on the person being nominated. And I liken Chris in many ways to Neil Gorsuch, who's nominated, of course, as Supreme Court Justice. Both extraordinarily qualified people. They might view things politically different than others, but the president of the United States is Donald Trump, and he's a Republican president, and he's charged with nominating people who share similar beliefs. I was pleased with Chris. I'm very pleased that his name surfaced because I know how independent he is, and he's somebody who would be, as I say, serving justice in the Constitution and not a particular person.
That is Kent Alexander. He's former U.S. Attorney for the North District of Georgia. Thank you so much.
A pleasure.
Now with us is John Iannarelli, a retired FBI special agent. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning.
It's good to have you. And by phone, we have Rhonda Cook, a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi, how are you?
Good. John, how much of the job of FBI director requires prior knowledge? In other words, let me ask you the same question I asked Kent. Are you concerned at all that the presumptive nominee is not somebody who has worked for the FBI?
Well, let me preface it by saying, first of all, I think Chris Wray will do a fine job. Is he the best pick for the job? I don't think so. When you look at prior directors, generally they have the substantive experience. For example, three of our prior FBI directors out of the five FBI directors the FBI has had over the course of time were federal judges. One FBI director had been an agent for a number of years as well. Director Comey was the first person to actually be slightly different and having not been a judge but yet had the substantial experience that requires an understanding the working knowledge of how the FBI operates, the mission of the FBI, and also very important is understanding the culture of the FBI.
Well, then let me play for you another comment that James Comey made during his Senate testimony.
And although the law required no reason at all to fire an FBI director, the administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI by saying that the organization was in disarray, that it was poorly led, that the workforce had lost confidence in its leader. Those were lies, plain and simple.
How did you take those, John, the comments that the FBI is in disarray?
I would totally disagree with the FBI being in disarray. Directors, honestly, just like any other leader in the FBI, they come and they go. What you do have is 36,000 employees, 12,000 of which are FBI special agents who are hired and have taken the oath to the Constitution to do a job, regardless of who is at the helm. Business goes on, and to say that anything was in disarray would be absolutely incorrect.
Rhonda, you started your longer piece on Christopher Wray by describing his connection with Bob Mueller, who's now the special prosecutor, investigating ties between the Trump administration and Russia, and also James Comey. How did Christopher Wray know both of those men?
They worked together. He was in the Justice Department when they had that infamous showdown involving then Attorney General John Ashcroft.
Over wiretapping.
Well, it was over extension of the surveillance that came after 9/11, yes.
And where did Christopher Wray come down in that argument?
From accounts that I've seen, there was a book that was written about Vice President Dick Cheney. What it explained was that he stopped Director Comey, or former Director Comey, in the hallway and said something to the effect, I don't know what's going on, but if you all are going to jump, let me know so I can go with you. So at that time, James Comey and Bob Mueller, had drafted letters of resignation that they were ready to submit over this issue. And Christopher Wray was planning, as were a number of other people in the Department of Justice, planning to resign and protest over how the White House was handling that.
Christopher Wray also has a connection with another person whose name might be familiar, and that is New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Here is Christie praising Christopher Wray's pick.
And the president deserves extraordinary credit for going through a really deliberative process and coming to the conclusion of picking not a politician, but a law enforcement professional who has the respect in both sides of the aisle.
It's hard to hear him there. It sounds like he's in a restaurant or something, but he's saying that Christopher Wray is a law enforcement professional with respect on both sides of the aisle. Rhonda, what is Christopher Wray's connection to Chris Christie?
Well, he was his private attorney. He was Governor Christie's private attorney during the Travelgate saga.
The Bridgegate?
Bridgegate, excuse me. Bridgegate. As of this moment, Chris Wray is, as you know, a litigation partner for the law firm King & Spalding, and they have offices in Washington. And so he represented Governor Christie in that instance.
What do you think... what do you think, John, are the necessary qualities that a successful FBI director needs?
So, again, I think Chris Wray is going to be fine, and I think he will do an adequate job. But I also think Chris Wray is a safe pick. If you're looking for somebody who's highly aggressive, somebody who understands the culture of the FBI, as well as the culture of law enforcement, which is very different than the culture of being a prosecutor or the practice of law, it's somebody who understands those aspects of what it takes to put together a complex investigation. The FBI, by its nature, are working violations that no other law enforcement agency literally in the world addresses. Some of these investigations, the statute of limitations are as long as 7 years because it takes so long to put these cases together, like an Enron-type case. Somebody with that frame of reference is the person who would be best to lead the FBI, but at the same time, you're looking at somebody who will be very aggressive, and perhaps at this time in the political culture, that's not what they're looking for to lead the FBI.
Well, let me try to get at what you're saying here. Does the FBI director, especially in this particular setting, need to have political savvy, do you think?
You know, I think understanding of the politics and being able to maneuver within those politics, but there's a reason the term of the director of the FBI is traditionally for 10 years, and that is so that you do not have to answer to one president over another. Director Louis Freeh was selected by Bill Clinton, yet clearly then became the nemesis to the Clintons to a certain degree later on, and that is because you may have selected me as director, but my job is to enforce the law regardless of politics. I think a director of the FBI has to understand certainly dealing with politics is going to be difficult, but you must rise above politics and do what is in the best interest of the country, regardless of what any politician, specifically any president, may wish for you to do.
Rhonda, how strong are Christopher Wray's connections to Georgia?
His wife is from here. Several generations have been here. They, at one point, I think it was her great-grandfather, was an owner of the Atlanta Constitution. I understand that the road Howell Mill was named for her family. So he came here from, I believe, New York State. But his tie to Georgia is his wife, but he's been here for a few decades. So it's pretty solid.
And so, John, let me go back to this idea of what is required of an FBI director. And this came up a number of times during the testimony when people were asking if the removal of James Comey would then have an impact on the investigation. How do we know what effect removing that director could have or might have?
If anybody's intention was to remove a director for the purpose of impacting an investigation, they wasted their time. I will tell you, the FBI carries on. The agents working cases are going to do what they're supposed to do, and they may receive direction by people to say, for example, close the case. If that was a direction that was inappropriate because there is a viable crime that has been committed and needs to be presented, that would be protested. It would not go over easily. I will tell you, in my 21 years with the FBI, I never saw an instance of where politics got in the way of pursuing cases. Now, the FBI, of course, doesn't indict. We investigate. We find the facts. I like to think of ourselves as scientists. We come back with the information. We present it to a grand jury. We present it to the United States Attorney's Office or the Department of Justice. What they decide to do with it is out of our control. But nevertheless, it is not going to slow down any investigation that may be going on involving the Russians or anything else because James Comey was asked to leave.
So then, Rhonda, what kind of high-profile investigations has Christopher Wray been connected to that might give us a clue to his law enforcement credentials?
Well, he was involved in the Enron investigation. He also played key roles in the anti-terrorism cases that came right after 9/11. So those are at least two situations he's been involved in.
And John, you say that you're okay with the choice of Christopher Wray, but it's possible someone else might have been better. Are you saying you would have preferred a judge?
Not necessarily a judge, but I've looked at some of the candidates who are out there. Jana Monroe, for example, former assistant director of the FBI. She started the FBI's cyber division, one of the leading females in the FBI. 30 years in law enforcement, 10 including on the local level as a homicide detective, 20 in the FBI to the highest ranks. John Pistol, who spent 25 years with the FBI, then went on to TSA. Mike Mason, our first African-American executive director at the FBI. There were a number of people that have extensive law enforcement and private sector experience, just like Mr. Wray, that were briefly considered, but these are all very strong individuals when it comes to making decisions to lead investigations, probably not the most politically correct persons. Perhaps that's why they were not seriously considered.
That is retired FBI Special Agent John Iannarelli and AJC reporter Rhonda Cook. We talked about new FBI Director Christopher Wray. He was confirmed by the U.S. Senate last week. Earlier in the conversation, we also heard from Kent Alexander, a former U.S. attorney for the North District of Georgia. And that's it for today's show, but we want to hear from you. We talked earlier about rising insurance premiums through Blue Cross Blue Shield, and we wanted to hear from you about what kind of policy you have and whether or not you're paying too much, in your opinion, for health insurance. Is it more than you can afford? Reach us on Facebook or tweet us at OST Talk, or just leave a message for us. The number is 404-500-9457. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.